count on you.
Ever covered.
Tonight, we're to cover 2 Corinthians 9 through 13. Before we get started, going verse by verse through chapter 9, or I almost should say section by section, I want us to very quickly get the perspective of 2 Corinthians in our mind again. 2 Corinthians is composed of three major items. And if you can get these three, that will be real good in terms of for the amount of time that you've had to cover 2 Corinthians. Now, basically, let me just put a real simple outline on the board. This isn't the first main point, but that's the introduction. There's a long introduction to 2 Corinthians. Do you remember? It's very personal. Paul has met Titus. He's happy about the news Titus has brought him concerning the Corinthians' response to the first letter. You remember, Paul was afraid that when he sent 1 Corinthians, they would react in an improper manner, or they would simply completely apostatize. Well, they've reacted properly, so he's happy. But the first main point begins with chapter 2, verse 12, and goes to the end of chapter 7. That's B, verse 16. I choose to entitle that section Paul's Principles of Action. What Paul does in those chapters that you talked about last week, and some of them the week before, is to describe the nature of his ministry. What was his ministry like? When I say his ministry, I mean his work with the Corinthians. He lists 9 different items. It was a triumphant ministry. That is, the gospel through Paul conquered. It was accredited by God. It was glorious, honest, suffering, etc. Okay? He makes an appeal to the Corinthians and he gives them some assurance. Now, basically, that's what's said here. Chapters 8 through 9 concern themselves with the collection for the needy saints in Jerusalem. Last week you covered chapter 8. Tonight we begin with chapter 9. And it's essential that you understand that these two chapters form a unit and that the two of them together discuss the aspect of the collection. And then in the final section, chapters 10 through 13, Paul deals with his apostleship, simply a defense of his apostleship. So tonight we're going to be discussing the last part of Paul's discussion concerning this collection and then his defense of his apostleship. So keep these points in mind. Don't lose yourself in the trees so you can't see the forest. All right? If you keep these uppermost in your mind, you won't have any problem. Chapter 9. Let me break this section down a little bit more, this second section. One of the things that helps me more than anything, if I have an outline and I can see how things work, how they break down, it helps me to know where I'm going. All right. Chapters 8 through 9 can be broken down like this. The first 15 verses of chapter 8, Paul simply encourages the Corinthians to give upon the basis of the Macedonians. He says, look at the Macedonians and their liberality. Now, according to their liberality, you do likewise. Beginning with verse 16 of chapter 8, and continuing through the 9th chapter and the 5th verse, Paul discusses the messengers. Do you remember? These had been mentioned in 1 Corinthians, the 16th chapter. Some of those messengers are described in Acts, the 20th chapter. Some of the ones that the churches had been selecting when Paul's on his third evangelistic tour that are accompanying him. So what about these messengers? Well, the last verses of the 8th chapter deal with the integrity of these messengers. They're honest, all right? But now, tonight, we begin right here in chapter 9, the first 5 verses, discussing the purpose of their coming. Why are these messengers coming? Now keep that point in mind. So let's begin. For as touching the ministering to the saints, and note again, I'm going to come back to this phrase, to the saints, and I just want you to note, who is the ministering to? To the saints. It is superfluous for me to write to you. Why? I don't even really need to write to you about this. You should, because I know you're ready. For I know your readiness, of which I glory on your behalf to them of Macedonia, that Achaia hath been prepared for a year past, and your zeal hath stirred up very many of them. I've been over here in Macedonia bragging on you Corinthians. Corinth's located in Achaia, right here. Okay, here's Achaia. Paul's been up here telling these brethren, well, the Corinthians have been ready for a year. You know, I mean, they're gung-ho on this thing. And so as a result, the Macedonians have been giving very liberally. But I have sent the brethren, here are these messengers. Now, the messengers, go back to chapter 8, verse 18. Titus, and with him the brother whose praise is in the gospel is spread through all the churches. Did Bill talk about who that was? Or who it could have been? Verse 18. Okay, we don't know, but here's a guess. Okay, and that's all it is. It's very possible that that's Luke. Now let me tell you why. Titus is not mentioned in the book of Acts by name. And yet we know Titus was with Paul. Paul tells us he was in Galatians 2. That you remember in Acts 15, the Jerusalem Council? Y'all think of those main points of Acts again, okay? The Jerusalem Council. Titus was with Paul. But Luke never mentions him. Why not? Well, it may be because Titus was Luke's brother. And there was it's a sign of humility. Luke doesn't mention his own name, nor does he mention his brother's name. Now that's, again, that's supposition, it's a guess. It's a logical guess. Okay, and that's about all you can say for it. If that's true, this may be Luke. His praise is known in all the churches. He would have a reputation. He's traveled with Paul. So, you think of someone associated with Titus, perhaps his own brother in the flesh, Luke. Now, that may be all wet, but that's a good guess. Okay. But I have sent the brethren, that our glorying on your behalf may not be made void in this respect, that even as I said, ye may be prepared, lest by any means, if there come with me any of Macedonia and find you unprepared, we say not ye, should be put to shame in this confidence. Now suppose we come, and we've been bragging to these brethren at Macedonia about the liberality of you Corinthians, and we get there and you're not ready. Now what's that going to make us look like? Well, Paul, you've been telling tall tales. You haven't been telling us the truth about these Corinthians. Now notice what he says. This is very sly. I say sly, it's not really sly. It makes the point. In verse 4, he says, and find you unprepared, we, that we say not ye, should be put to shame in this confidence. We'll look like fools if you're not ready. Has that ever happened to you? You know, you brag about this certain river or this, when I get to talking to somebody and say, well, man, you just go fishing with me over here. Boy, we just pull them out right and left, and you go and you don't even get a strike. How do you feel? Pretty rotten. Okay, well, that's the same type of principle that's going on here. But Paul reminds them, he says, not only us, but you too. All right, how are you going to feel? You're going to feel pretty bad about the whole thing. Also, the word confidence, we're not going to have time to deal with very many details. The word confidence here is significant because it means standing under. But this is the term that is used, a similar term, in Hebrews, the first chapter, with reference to Christ, when it says that Jesus was the essence of God, who being the effulgence of His glory and the very image, or the essence, of His substance. Substance is the term here. Same basic word, okay? So you can just remember that. I thought it necessary, therefore, to entreat the brethren that they would go before unto you and make up beforehand your aforepromised bounty, that the same might be ready as a matter of bounty and not of extortion. Okay, extortion is simply a desire to have more, but basically, but here he means so that you'll already have it ready and it won't look like we've come and we're forcing you to give this by our presence. So that's why the messengers have been sent. Now these are not the messengers that the Corinthians will send to Jerusalem. Okay? These are the messengers Paul sends to the church of Corinth to prepare the collection. Beginning with verse 6, we're going to change our thought. And here, he's going to go back to a similar thought that he'd been discussing in the first 15 verses of chapter 8, and that is liberality. The key word perhaps in chapter 8 is equality. You talked about that, didn't you? The concept, they're in want, so you supply their need. Later, you may be in want, they'll supply your need. The key word in chapter 9 is liberality. But this I say, he that soweth sparingly shall also reap sparingly, and he that soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. The principle is taken from nature. If you go out and you sow a few seeds in a field, do you expect to get a bumper crop? No. If you expect a bumper crop, you have really got to put the seeds out in the field. Well, Paul is saying the same thing is true spiritually. If you intend to reap a bountiful spiritual crop, then you must sow bountifully. Now, people have misunderstood this verse to an extent. And many people have the idea that if I give more, that the Lord will give me more physically. I don't think that's true. I think the scriptures, and I don't think it's being said here, because here he's discussing spiritual giving. Well, you're giving physically, but you're not hoping to reap physically. You're hoping to reap something spiritual. But there's this notion that a lot of people have that let's just say I'm giving $30 a week, okay? And I decide, well, I'll just give $45 a week. And if I give $45 a week, the Lord's probably going to see that my employer gives me a raise. And I'll make more money than I am now. Now, there are a lot of people that have that idea. Well, the Bible teaches that giving is sacrificial. The whole point is that you won't have what you do have. And if you get a raise, your giving ought to increase and be commensurate with your raise. So, again, I don't know that any of you would think that, but a lot of people have that idea. Let each man do according as he hath purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver. And the same thought basically is being expressed here. The idea, there are a lot of people. Well, the first point is that a man should give as he's purposed in his heart. Giving should not be haphazard. And he told the Corinthians, what, in the first epistle, the 16th chapter? Lay by in store, and you do this on the first day of the week. Every first day of the week, you lay by in store. So if you've purposed, then it's not a haphazard matter, and you won't have these problems. Not grudgingly, that is, well, I just have to, or of necessity. There are a lot of people that may give simply because they see everybody else giving. That's not the point, but Paul says, for God loveth a cheerful giver. Now let me write this word up there, up here on the board. You tell me the English word. Jeanette, you should be able to recognize that. What English word comes from that Greek? Hilarious. For God loveth a hilarious giver. All right? That's the idea in the word. And it doesn't mean that when you put your money in the plate that you have a smile on your face. But it's a recognition that I'm giving back to God that which He has given to me. And you see, the whole emphasis of everything Paul is saying is on liberality. And God is able to make all grace abound unto you, that ye, having always all sufficiency in everything, may abound unto every good work. What he is saying is that the Corinthians might reason like this. Well, suppose we give this money. Well, then we're not going to have, if we give this all to Jerusalem, we'll be deprived of any good that we can do. Well, again, Paul is reminding them of the sufficiency of God and that God will take care and will make sure that you're capable of fulfilling your responsibilities. As it is written, he that he has scattered abroad, he hath given to the poor. His righteousness abideth forever. Now that's the righteousness of God in verse 9. When you come down to verse 10, and he that supplieth seed to the sower and bread for food shall supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the fruits of your righteousness. That's the Corinthians' righteousness. Okay? Be sure you note the distinction. Now this is his point. In verse 9, the quotation from Psalms, Psalm 112:9, what has the Lord done? All right, he's scattered abroad. He's sown bountifully. He's given to the poor. What's Paul trying to get them to do? To give to the poor. His righteousness abideth forever. What connection does his righteousness have with scattering abroad into the poor? Giving to the poor. Sure. It's a manifestation of his righteousness. Okay? Now in verse 10, he comes back to the seed and the sower. All right, he hadn't left that. He's still on the same thought. And he that supplies seed to the sower and bread for food. Now note that. This is real easy to overlook. What does seed turn into? Grain. What is grain made into? Bread. And that's food. So he that supplies seed to the sower and bread for food. So the seed turns into the bread for food. Okay? Now that's God that supplies the seed. Shall supply and multiply your seed for sowing. What seed here? The seed back up in verse 6. All right? God will multiply that and increase the fruits of your righteousness. Now what is he saying? Well, you go out and you plant a seed in the ground. The result is that you have grain that you make bread, food from. Corinthians give to the needy saints at Jerusalem, and the result is that God will bless you, that you will reap a spiritual harvest, that God will not only bless you in this aspect, but that you'll have food. Not only do you have a crop, but that crop turns into food, and if you want to keep the analogy or the parallel that Paul is drawing, that all of your righteousness will be multiplied, will be fruitful. Ye being enriched in everything unto all liberality, which worketh through us thanksgiving to God. Now, there's an important term in verse 10 that needs to be mentioned. The term supplieth, he that supplieth, is the word which literally means to lead a chorus. One of the things of ancient Greece, one of the main items on in terms of culture were the plays that were produced annually, the festivals. And these festivals, if you know anything about ancient drama, they didn't have men and women actors, or actors and actresses, etc. But most of the time they'd have very few actors, and then they would have a large chorus that would help fill in. Sometimes they'd be the townspeople and they had different roles. All right? But in order to keep that chorus supplied and equipped, you had to have someone with a lot of money to do that. So what happened is someone, say, from Athens that wanted to have a better chorus than the fella at Sparta or something like that would say, okay, I'll take on this chorus just for the sake of promoting Athens. And so he would supply that chorus, and he would, his attitude wasn't, well, okay, get the cheapest costumes you can, you know. This was an all-out thing. Well, you get the best you can. Well, that's the term. It means just simply to supply, to equip. All right? That's the term Paul is using. The Corinthians would know the history of that term. They would recognize it. They would see the significance of it. So the emphasis is again, where? On what? What? Liberality. And there is the key word used in verse 11. And it means literally singleness. Okay? If you'll look at your margin, the same term was used back in chapter 8 in verse 2. Sincerity is also, it simply means single as opposed to double. Okay? Now, this results through us thanksgiving to God. We thank God for it. For the ministration of this service not only filleth up the measure of the wants of the saints, but aboundeth also through many thanksgivings unto God, seeing that through the proving of you by this ministration, they glorify God for the obedience of your confession unto the gospel of Christ, and for the liberality of your contribution unto them and unto all. Okay, in verse 10, not only will you supply their needs, their physical needs, but what else is going to happen? What about their prayers? What are they going to think of you? What are they going to realize in verse 13 about you? They're going to come to a realization that you are proving yourself, you are Christians. Now the idea is this, if you're a Christian, aren't there certain things expected of you, the way you act? Sure. Now suppose you're a Christian and you see another Christian in need, destitute. What's expected of you? To help them. Now what happens if you don't? Are they going to think you're a Christian? No. You might call yourself one, but they're sure not going to believe you're one. Well, that's the point. You've proven your Christianity. You've proven the profession, Paul says, or the confession, your confession unto the gospel, and for the liberality of your contribution unto them and unto all. This verse has caused a great deal of trouble, all right? And this was one of the verses that was argued and argued and argued over in the 1950s. The argument hinges on the term all. Okay, let me explain it. Let me go back just a minute and begin with verse 12 carefully and lay the foundation. Ministry, or this service, I mean, the term service of this service is a term which almost always meant, in the New Testament, some sort of religious activity. Okay? It's the same word that's used in Romans 12 by Paul when he talks about, let me just read it and get it right. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service. There's the same term. Okay? So it's a religious activity, and this gift is worship. It is a religious service. It's to be considered as such. Now, if you'll note in verse 12 that this gift fills up the measure of the wants of the saints. Now, I want to make 4 points about this right here. To whom was the gift to go? In chapter 8, verse 4, Paul says it was to go to the saints. In chapter 9, verse 1, Paul says it was to go to the saints. And in chapter 9, verse 12, Paul says it was to go to the saints. Now, who is it going to? It's going to the saints. There's no doubt. So there are four points that can be made about these verses. Number one, money was raised for the saints. That's 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, and Romans 15, 26. You should have talked about those passages in your Acts class. Point number two, money was sent to the saints. 1 Corinthians 16, 3, Romans 15, 25 again. All right, 26 the first time, 25 here. Point number three, money was received by the saints. And you can look at the reference in Acts 21 if you want that. And point number four, according to this verse, money supplied the wants of the saints. Now, I mean, no one disagrees with that. It's just black and white. What's the problem? Okay, here's the problem. What about this all? The liberality unto them and unto all. Who are the all?
All saints.
All saints. Now, a lot of people have problems studying their Bibles because they don't keep things in context. They ramble all over. And they come to a point and they take one passage and pull it out and they're going to stand on this one passage and they totally ignore everything around it. Okay, if you just look, just what we've gone through and shown you, the entire context, not only of 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, but of 1 Corinthians 16 and of Romans 15, the passages dealing with this collection all specify it goes to the saints. Now, when you have the term all used in Scripture, and I don't care where it's used, it is used in a limited sense in some way. It is never unlimited. Let me give you some illustrations. The easiest one, and one that will... Well, there are two that I think of off the top of my head. Acts 1:1. The former treatise I made, O Theophilus, concerning all that Jesus began both to do and to teach. Now, did Luke write everything Jesus did in his gospel? No, not at all. But what when he uses the term all there, he's showing it in the sense that he's giving a complete history of Christ's life. It's a history of Christ's life, of all of his life. That's the emphasis. But the all is limited. You wouldn't say it was unlimited. Well, Christ said in the Gospel of John, I forgot the exact reference, he said, when I'm lifted up, I will draw all men unto myself. You want to find the passage, look in your concordance under draw and look for a reference in the Gospel of John. Well, does that mean that Christ was a universalist? Everybody's going to be saved? No. All is again limited. Limited by what? Limited by the other things he said. Limited by obedience. Okay. Now, my point is that all is limited in this context. Now, in the 50s, there was a movement for people to take money out of the church treasury and to give it to or to support orphanages with that money. And the result was that there was a split in the Lord's church over it. And the question that has to be asked is this. Is it biblical to do that? Now, no one that I know is opposed to an orphan, helping an orphan. If they are, they're not a Christian. But the question is that the work of the church? In the New Testament, it is not. Okay? In the New Testament, money was given only to the saints from the treasury of the church. Now, what about me as an individual Christian? Am I to help all men? Most definitely. There's no doubt about that. But you see, just think about this logically. Suppose the church were saddled with caring for the poor of the world. What would happen to it? Every congregation in the world would be bankrupt overnight. We couldn't even care for the poor in Houston, which is, compared to the rest of the world, is a very wealthy city. That's not our responsibility. Now, if they're saints, it's a different story. Okay, now we don't have time to talk about it in any more detail. I wish we did. Let me recommend two books. And this same issue, this same principle, has divided the church twice in the last 100 years. It's pretty important. Okay, now I say twice. Actually, you know, you might say, well, instrumental music divided it the first time. Well, it was actually the Missionary Society and the Civil War that started the break. Instrumental music was just the straw that broke the camel's back. That's all it amounts to. The first one you've seen, I'm sure, and heard Brother Cogdell's work, Walking by Faith. It's a real short little book, but it's real good. It's a series of sermons. It's his outlines, but the outlines are very detailed, and it's real good. The other one I recommend very highly also. It's called the Arlington Meeting. And up here in Arlington, Texas, is Arlington out of Fort Worth or Dallas? Fort Worth. In between. Okay. A number of men, 26 men, got together and discussed the issues that confronted the church in the 1950s and early 1960s. Okay, 13 on each side. And this book is a compilation of their speeches, and their attitudes are good all the way through. It's not a personal mudslinging contest, and you have the best of both sides presented. So that's why I like to recommend this book. Okay, the Arlington Meeting. And again, it'd sure be worth your time to read those two books. We've got to go on. Okay. Then he says in verse 14, while they themselves also with supplication on your behalf long after you by reason of the exceeding grace of God in you. So when you give, the result is that their needs are going to be supplied, and they're going to lift their voices up in prayer to God and thanksgiving for you. Thanks be to God for His unspeakable gift. So it's the bond of Christianity. Any questions? Now, I dealt with that more time than the other, because that's been the subject that has been of more vital concern at present to members of the church. Chapter 10. Now look at the English, and the English is striking here, and you have to look at this very carefully. Now I, Paul, myself, who's he going to talk about? Have any doubt? All right, now in English you get the idea that Paul mentions himself 3 times, in Greek 4 times. Right here, he's pretty emphatic, isn't he? Because it is Paul now, versus the false apostles, the super duper apostles, as he'll call them a little bit later. So, now I, Paul, myself, entreat you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. Meekness means not simply humility, but it's the fact, it's the person that God controls their life. That's the basic idea. And if God does control a person's life, they are humble. Humility, let me say this. Humility is based upon 2 concepts. If I understand who and what God is, then I'm going to be humble. And if I understand who and what I am. See, the problem is too many of us compare ourselves with ourselves or compare ourselves with someone else. That's not the rod of comparison. God is the standard. And if I'll just use that standard, I'll be humble. Okay. Gentleness, graciousness is the idea. And you see the 2 terms used. And then he also, lowly among you. All 3 of these terms being used, and the good courage has been mentioned a number of times in this epistle. Yea, I beseech you, that I may not, when present, show courage with the confidence wherewith I count to be bold against some who count of us as if we walked according to the flesh. All right, they are reckoning, counting us as if we warred against the flesh, as if this were our battleground. Okay, now this is what he's going to show us, that this is their battleground. In chapter 10, now we're starting the last section of the book. Let me give you part of this outline, continue in an outline so that you'll have the hooks to hang the meat from, so to speak. But the first 18 verses of chapter 10 are concerned with what we'll call the divine power. And there are two things about this divine power. First of all, the first 11 verses discuss the working of this divine power, its activity, its exercise. Verses 12 through 18 discuss its measure, its extent. How far does it go? Okay, now keep those two thoughts in mind, everything will make sense. He goes on now with this in mind. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. Yeah, we have physical bodies, but that's not where our warfare is. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but mighty before God to the casting down of the strongholds. Now, if you look at McGarvey's commentary, he talks about a machine, an ancient machine. He says this might have reference to it. Well, they would come up against the wall and they'd put this on this wall and then pull the wall down. Okay? Maybe that's what he has reference to. The terms here in the original are militaristic terms. For instance, the term "we do not war" is a military term. So Paul is definitely using these figures. Okay. Casting down. They're going to cast down strongholds. Now, how are they going to do that? Casting down imaginations or reasonings, sophistries, as we might call them today, and every high thing that is exalted against the knowledge of God. What does this sound like to you? Can you think in this course, when have you talked about something that's very similar? Think way back to the beginning of the course. First Corinthians 1 and 2. What's he discussing? The wisdom of God versus the wisdom of men. Isn't that what he discusses? Doesn't he show there the weakness of the wisdom of men? Now here he's showing the apostles in their warfare casting down sophistries, which would parallel the wisdom of men, okay? And bringing in every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ and being in readiness to avenge all disobedience when your obedience shall be made full. The high thing is actually, now let me go back and talk about some of these words in particular in verses 5 and 6. Verse 5, every high thing. High thing is an astronomical term. That's why it's translated high thing. The space above the horizon, the area above the earth's surface. Okay? All of these high things that raise themselves up against God, these will be brought into captivity to Christ. Now, they are ready to avenge. The term avenge in verse 6 means out of justice. So what is he saying? We're simply carrying out justice. Now here's another thing that I think is real interesting. The terms disobedience and obedience come, what happens is there's one root. Here's the root. Akouo. We get our word acoustics from it. In English, we talk about the acoustics of a ceiling. All right, that's where acoustics comes from. And what Paul does is he's going to add two different prepositions to this word to get either obedience or disobedience. Now, to make disobedience, he adds that preposition, par, para. And what it means is, I hear alongside of. The thought is this, put it in a graph. Here comes the message of God. It's coming down over here. Where am I hearing? Well, I just step aside and let it go right on by. I'm not standing where I can hear that. Now, when he says obedience, he puts that preposition, hupa, which means under. So if I'm obedient, I hear under. I just hear the voice. So what is obedience? Obedience is hearing the voice of God. Disobedience is rejecting the voice of God. If you want an example of disobedience, maybe this will help fix this in your mind. I think of the plays of Shakespeare. You know, the soliloquies, the asides. A player will go off to the side of a stage and he'll talk to himself. And nobody else on the stage is supposed to hear what's going on. He's all off to himself. Okay, here's this idea. Disobedience. Hearing beside or aside. I think that's real interesting. It helps give a person a concept of what he means. You look at the things that are before your face. If any man trusteth in himself that he is Christ, let him consider this again with himself, that even as he is Christ, so also are we. You think you're Christ, but what about us? Who do you think we are? To whom do we belong? Now, who are the us? The we. Okay. That's exactly right. And here it would be, when we say apostles, perhaps more specifically would be Paul, Timothy, would be included in this group. Not the 12 original necessarily, but Paul as an apostle and those that had ministered to the Corinthian church, that had preached the gospel to the Corinthian church. What's the conflict that rages in 2 Corinthians? What are these men, these false teachers teaching?
They're saying that he's not a real apostle.
Okay. What are they saying about Christianity? What are they trying to reimpose? Sure, Judaism. Now that's chapter 3. You remember the contrast there between the ministration of life and the ministration of death. Okay. The ministration of death is the old law. The ministration of life is the gospel. So these are the men he's in conflict with. For though I should glory somewhat abundantly concerning our authority, which the Lord gave for building you up and not for casting you down, I shall not be put to shame. All right, now I was given authority not for the purpose of destroying, but for the purpose of building up or edifying, that I may not seem as if I would terrify you by my letters. For his letters, they say, are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech is of no account. Here are the enemies of Paul. Oh yeah, Paul sounds tough in those letters. Like the lion. But he's like the dog that fights all kinds of battles through the fence. But you get him out in the yard and he'll tuck tail. That's what they're saying. Okay? So Paul's going to answer that. Let such a one reckon this, that what we are in word by letters when we are absent, such are we also indeed when we are present. And anything that knows anything about the Apostle Paul would rather listen to the letter if they were in trouble than have him present. But then he makes a point about them. Now, what has he been talking about in these first 11 verses? And I'm going so fast. I know it's hard to get all of the thoughts. So what I want you to do, I'm touching only on a few details, get the main thought. He's talking about this, the exercising of this divine power. What's this divine power going to do? What can it do? It will destroy their sophistries. They may think it's only in letter, but it's more than that. Now, what about its measure? How far does this divine power go? Now, keep in mind, this is in contrast with these enemies. For we are not bold to number or compare ourselves with certain of them that commend themselves, but they themselves measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves with themselves are without understanding. Now, what are they doing? Well, they're looking at their own lives and they're saying, well, you know, I'm not such a bad fellow. I mean, after all, look what I've done. And so slap their, pat themselves on the back, you know, and, I'm doing all right. Paul says they're without understanding. They have compared themselves by the wrong standard. To number, let me give you the meaning of a couple of these terms so to help you to understand. Number means to class, to put somebody in a category. To compare is to combine, to judge with. Now there's a little play here. Here you have the same root again, number and compare. They are classing themselves. Let's see if we get this exactly right. They are classing themselves, or we are not bold to class ourselves compare ourselves, class ourselves alongside ourselves with certain of them that are doing this. But, verse 13, we will not, we will not go glory beyond our measure, but according to the measure of the province which God apportioned to us as a measure to reach even unto you. For we stretch not ourselves overmuch as though we reached not unto you, for we came even as far as unto you in the gospel of Christ. Not glorying beyond our measure, that is, in other men's labors, but having hope that as your faith groweth, we shall be magnified in you according to our province unto a further abundance. Now let me stop and let's get the thought. Okay, where did Paul go? Where's Corinth? The measure, the extent, is Corinth. And even beyond, he says. Now Paul's saying, look, when we came, we preached the gospel. No one else had preached the gospel to you. We haven't gone into somebody else's territory and preached the gospel. We taught you the gospel for the first time. We're not so bold as these others, and now these are the false teachers. That these false teachers aren't concerned with going out and with saving the world. What are they concerned with? After there's a church established, then they come in and cause all kind of trouble. You see, there's an extent, there's a limitation. They're not recognizing their limitation. They're so busy perverting, they don't have any time to convert. Only time to pervert. Okay? That's roughly the thought. So as to preach the gospel even unto the parts beyond you, and not to glory in another's province in regard of things ready to our hand. You have you seen the thought now of what he's saying? Now he's talking about this divine power. That's the general thought. Keep that in your minds. What about this divine power? Well, it's going to tear down their sophistries. But what else about it? It has an extent. And our extent was even to you and beyond. But their extent doesn't go that far. So why are you listening to him? That's his whole point. By the way, the term province used in verse 13, I just think this is interesting, is the word that we get our English word canon from. Now that's not boom, boom, like canon of scripture, the collection of sacred writings. When we say canon, what I mean, say for instance in this sentence, the canon of the New Testament. All inspired writings that belong to the New Testament, Matthew through Revelation. Okay.
just go through these, pick out only the important things. But he that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord. For not he that commendeth himself is approved, but whom the Lord commendeth. Now, in verse 18, when he says, not he that commendeth himself is approved, who's commending themselves? Who are commending themselves? Sure, what are they doing? They measure themselves by themselves, pat themselves on the back, and say, you're a great fellow. Paul says, that doesn't matter. What matters? Who does the Lord commend? That's the question. All right? So let him glory, but let him glory in the Lord. And it's who the Lord commends that's important. Verse or chapter 11. Now we shift a little bit, and we're going to begin discussing what can be called the godly jealousy. 15 verses. For this point. The godly jealousy. Would that ye could bear with me in a little foolishness. But indeed ye do bear with me. For I am jealous over you with a godly jealousy, for I espoused you to one husband, that I might present you as a pure virgin to Christ. All right. Now there's some interesting words in here, some that you just may appreciate. For instance, the word espoused is the word we get our English word harmonized from it. All right? So the idea is when you espouse someone, to give them as husband and wife, you're harmonizing. Now, I realize that in every case, harmony is not the result. But that's the intention. Okay. So what has Paul done? Well, here's the figure. I've given you, the Corinthians, to Christ as his bride, as a pure virgin, pure in the sense that you were unadulterated by the philosophies, by the wisdom of men. But I fear, lest by any means, as the serpent beguiled Eve in his craftiness, what's that have reference to? What chapter is that? What book and chapter? Genesis. Come on, Jeanette, you should remember that. Elizabeth's in that class too. All right, you think Genesis 1 is creation, Genesis 2 goes back and talks about the creation of man, so Genesis 3, man sins. All right, just think of them in logical order and you'll get it. Okay. Craftiness literally means ready to do anything. All working. So he was willing to try anything to deceive her. Now I fear just that you will fall prey to him likewise. Your mind should be corrupted from the simplicity and the purity that is toward Christ. The simplicity and purity toward Christ has the idea of the singleness of purpose, being turned towards Christ, that you'll be deceived and be diverted from off that single path towards Christ by the deceiver. For if he that cometh preacheth another Jesus. Now, that statement is an affirmation. That's a fact. Someone is coming and preaching another Jesus. Okay, now look at this verse very carefully. For if he that cometh preacheth another Jesus, whom we did not preach, or if ye receive a different spirit, which ye did not receive, or a different gospel. Now, you'll note, see, the American Standard properly translates the English by different terms. Another means another of the same kind. Different, that's used twice here, means of a different kind, not of the same kind. Okay, in the original, there are two different words used between one for another and a different word for different. The word for different is heteros, heterorthodoxy. Not orthodox, heterosexual, of a different sect, not male, female, or not female, male. That's the idea, all right? Same word in English that it was in Greek. Same meaning. So, these people are coming, they're preaching another Jesus, one of the same class. They're not preaching the Christ. What are they preaching? Well, they're contrived Jesus. All right? And now he says, if you receive a different spirit, a spirit of a different kind, well, obviously, while they may preach someone that's something like Jesus, the spirit isn't going to be the same. You're not going to receive the Holy Spirit, and it won't be the same gospel. It's going to be a gospel of a different kind. All right? Then he says, now if that happens, which ye did not accept, ye do well to bear with him. Yeah, you ought to listen to him, if that's what he's coming and doing. But what are they doing? If he can prove that there was another man, that was just like Jesus, equivalent to Jesus, then you better listen to him. But can they prove it? Not on your life. Not on their lives. That's his whole point. They have no proof. Anybody can come and make bold assertions. He's going to get to that. All right? So, verse 5. For I reckon that I am not a whit behind the very chiefest apostles. Okay. Chiefest means, you can just translate that, the super apostles. Now, these are not the 12 original apostles. Paul isn't saying, well, Peter, Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, etc., that these men are super apostles. I mean, if you think about that, can you picture Paul saying that? Not at all. It's sarcasm all the way through. He's being very sarcastic. Well, these super apostles that come to you, now how do you know they're super? Well, just ask them, they'll tell you. They'll tell you how great they are. He says, I'm not a whit behind them. You see, the contrast isn't between Paul and the original 12. It's between Paul and these Judaizers. There's the contrast. There's the battle. So these men have come in and they're claiming to be apostles. They've got this a different gospel. Let them prove it. But though I be rude in speech, this has been an accusation. I'm not really sure in my own mind that Paul was a poor speaker. You have to understand, this passage is full of sarcasm. And Paul says, all right, just grant that I am rude in speech. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that I'm not polished. Okay? Yet I am not in knowledge. Nay, in every way have we made this manifest unto you in all things. You have to admit that, Corinthians. So why are you so set on these? Is his whole point that he's making. Now, then he's going to continue. Or did I commit a sin in abasing myself that ye might be exalted because I preached to you the gospel of Christ for naught? What did the Corinthians argue? Well, apparently these false teachers have come in and they've said this. Paul is so ashamed of the fact that he's not really an apostle, but he just pretends to be one. That bothers him so much that that's why he wouldn't take money from you. Just bothers his conscience. So what's Paul saying? Brethren, did I commit a sin when I abased, when I humbled myself so that I wouldn't make you support me? And really what he's doing is he's almost slapping the Corinthians in the face and he's saying, look, don't you have any more appreciation than what you've shown? Here he'd come in and labored. He robbed other churches, he says. And you take that and believe that I'm not an apostle because I wouldn't accept wages from you. Is that the big point? Is that the big argument? And when I was present with you, verse 9, and was in want, I was not a burden on any man, for the brethren, when they came from Macedonia, supplied the measure of my want, and in everything I kept myself from being burdensome unto you, and so will I keep myself. No man will stop me from this glory. Why? Because I love you not? Is that why I didn't take any money from you? Now just think, Corinthians. If I were an imposter and I were a shrewd man, what would I do? I'd soak you for every dime I could get. Now that happens. That happens in religion all the time. A while ago last summer, we were in Denver. And there was a great big stink there. Some preacher had taken people up there for over $1 million. And it happens. But it doesn't happen when the preacher works for free. You could be assured of that. But what I do, that I will do, that I may cut off occasion from them that desire an occasion, that wherein they glory they may be found even as we. The reason I didn't accept wages was so that I wouldn't give them a chance to accuse me. Now, suppose I had accepted wages, what would they say then? Oh, he just preaches for the money. You know that's why he's preaching. So he shows them the dilemma. Now, verse 13 through verse 15, he begins to expose these false people. For such men are false apostles. Now, such men, who men? What men? The super apostles. The super apostles are pseudo apostles. They're false apostles. Deceitful workers fashioning themselves into apostles of Christ. And no marvel, for even Satan fashioneth himself into an angel of light. If even Satan can deceive by, in effect, by making himself appear as an angel, or in the role of an angel, that is to say, if Satan can work through men, and he looks like what he's doing is right, it's good, he's honorable, but it's Satan and it's not good, so why do you marvel at these men that come and claim to be apostles or just simply servants of Satan? It is no great thing, therefore, if his ministers also fashion themselves as ministers of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their works. Whose ministers? Who are Satan's ministers here? These super apostles, these false apostles. Now, beginning with verse 16, he changes and he's going to discuss what we'll call the enforced boasting. Is Paul a humble man? Yes, very much so. He's a tender man. You know, a lot of people have misconceptions of Paul. They think of Paul as the iron-faced, walks around, you know, cuts everybody in two with his look. Well, he could, but that's not always the case. In 2 Corinthians, many things show that not to be true. But what happens here is basically is this. These Corinthians are listening to these false apostles. And these false apostles come in and say, look, I can trace my genealogy all the way back. I'll show you that I'm of the prime stock of Israel. I've really come from a great inheritance. And all of the things that I suffered as this apostle. And so they just list them off to the Corinthians. The Corinthians eating that up. Man, can you believe what he's gone through? That's basically the situation. So Paul says, okay, I don't want to, but look, if this is the standard, if this is the criteria by which you're going to judge, then look at mine. And he's going to make them look like they've had a holiday for all of their life because of his own life. Okay? And it's going to bother him, though, when he does it. And there are going to be some reservations that he's going to throw in. I say again, let no man think me foolish. All right? The term foolish means without sense, without a mind. Let nobody think me without a mind. But if you do, yet as foolish receive me, that I also may glory a little. All right, I realize this is foolishness, but this is what you want. This is a standard you're using to judge by. So judge me by it. This is what you want to use. That which I speak not after the Lord, but as in foolishness, in this confidence of glory. I want you to know that this isn't the Lord's standard. This is foolishness, but it's your standard. Seeing that many glory after the flesh, I will glory also. Who are the many? Well, the false apostles, the super apostles. For ye bear with the foolish gladly, being wise yourselves. Now, are they really wise? No, probably they told Paul they were. It's very likely they said that in their letter. But that's what they think of themselves. No, look at how intelligent we are. We accept these men. What is he going back to? All the way back to 1 Corinthians 1 and 2. The wisdom of God versus the foolishness of men. Here you have that same problem coming up again. So he continues. For ye bear with the man if he bringeth you into bondage. If he devoureth you, if he taketh you captive, if he exalteth himself, if he smiteth you on the face. Corinthians, what kind of a fellow do you like? Well, if he takes you for everything you're worth, you just love him. You think he's wonderful. For ye, if I speak by way of disparagement, as though we had been weak, yet wherensoever any is bold, and note the parenthetical statement, I speak in foolishness. Again, he comes back to that point. He realizes this isn't what the Lord wants. This isn't how the Lord measures men. But this is how the Corinthians measure men. I am bold also. Okay. He's described what these false teachers have done when they've come in. Now, do you want to hear my story? Here it is. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. Now, probably what these statements are is their own criterion this far. Well, I'm a Hebrew. I'm an Israelite. I'm a descendant of the seed of Abraham. Well, look at my heritage. A lot of the Corinthians wouldn't have that. Be Gentiles. Well, I'm inheritors of this promise for 2,000 years. A little over 2,000 years. And he continues, are they ministers of Christ? I speak as one beside himself. Just can't stand it. I more. In labors more abundantly. In prisons more abundantly. In stripes above measure. In deaths oft. Of the Jews 5 times received I 40 stripes, save one. Why did the Jews only whip 39 times, strike 39 times? You know? Do you remember? Loud 40, and the Pharisees were afraid someone would forget. Yeah, which would be an easy thing to do. By the way, when you read of the beatings of Paul in the book of Acts from the Romans didn't count. They had no limit. He continues, thrice was I beaten with rods, once was I stoned, thrice I suffered shipwreck, a night and a day have I been in the deep. Now we know when one of those shipwrecks was, we don't know when the other two were, and we don't know when he was a night and a day in the deep. Thought I said that wrong. A lot of these things were omitted by Luke and Acts, most of them. Why? No, that's right. He sure couldn't. And they weren't according to his purpose, were they? Does Luke present Paul in the heroic sense that we would think of a hero in a novel today? No. Who's the hero in Acts? The Lord. Isn't that right? Acts is a continuation of Luke. All right, continuation of how Jesus worked, just not on earth, he's in heaven now. It's a triumph of the gospel. Paul is God's agent through whom that gospel is preached. Well, you see, that's the reason. Because these things present Paul as being great, don't they? I mean, if you think about the things listed here, you think, look at all he's done. What have I done? And you realize the greatness of the Apostle Paul, his faith, his perseverance, his patience. I mean, steadfastness when I say patience. Okay. And he goes on, he continues. You can just read that as he goes on. And then note verse 28. Beside those things that are without, there is that which presseth upon me daily, anxiety for all the churches. There's something that's pressing upon him. This is a type of an inward strain, and perhaps it's greater than the burden of all of the physical maladies, of all the physical sufferings combined. And that is the care of the churches. Paul planted these churches. I mean, he labored. He nearly gave his life for the establishment of these congregations. And all through their history, he has this fear, and very rightly so, that they're about to be swept into apostasy. Have you ever worked for anything for a number of years, and then you stand and you watch it as somebody else begins to destroy it? Have you ever seen that happen? I have. And it breaks your heart. There's a pressure that's put on you in that type of circumstance. Now, it hasn't happened to me. I'm not old enough to have labored that long. But I've seen it happen. Well, in my case, I've seen it happen to my father. And I saw what it did to him, the pressure. All right. That's what Paul's talking about. Who is weak, and I am not weak? Who is caused to stumble, and I burn not? Stumble means stumble to sin. What he's saying is, I have empathy with every Christian in these churches. I have an emotional affinity with them, a spiritual affinity with them. There's a bond between us. Verse 30. If I must needs glory, I will glory of the things that concern my weakness. Now, you think about something. You think about that statement. Okay. If you were going to present a man today that was great, how would you present him as being great? Well, okay. He was educated at such and such. That's probably where you'd start. All right. Fought in World War II. Was a lieutenant colonel, you know, received the gold medal of honor, Purple Heart, and enlisted his medals he won. Successful businessman. All of the glories, all the successes. Would you talk about the times when he was defeated? No, you wouldn't mention them. Yet what has Paul done? He's just given you a list of all of the times he's been defeated. Hasn't he? Isn't that what he's talking about? Weaknesses. So what he does, he doesn't talk about his triumphs. Now you see, Paul could have written a list like this. Well, I planted churches in Cyprus. I planted churches in Cilicia. I planted churches in Asia Minor. I've taught the gospel in Macedonia, in Achaia. I preached the word throughout the Mediterranean world. You know, like some preachers. Now let's see, yeah, I've converted this many people to date. You know, they've got a record. And that's their criteria, by their faithfulness. I hold so many meetings a year. That's another standard that preachers use. You'd be surprised. People ask me, some of the guys I went to school with, first thing they want to know is, how many meetings do you hold a year? That's no determination of whether or not I'm a faithful preacher of God's word. But Paul could have written a list like that, but he chose to glory in his weaknesses. continuing. The God and Father, Lord Jesus Christ, he who is blessed forevermore, knoweth that I lie not. In Damascus, the governor under Aretas the king guarded the city of the Damascenes in order to take me, and through a window was I let down in a basket by the wall and escaped his hands. When did that happen?
All right, way back in Acts. Where in Acts? Well, if you had to put it in a chapter, you'd have to put it in chapter 9. Okay, and I was trying to remember, I didn't write this in my notes. Remember when Paul was converted, he went into Damascus, then he went into Arabia, according to Galatians 1. Then he goes back to Damascus, okay? It's this time when he's in Damascus when he leaves. That would be Acts 9, 23 through 25. When he leaves Damascus and he goes to Jerusalem. Okay, the Jews have a plot. And apparently, that's what Luke tells you, apparently they've persuaded the governor to help him guard the city. Now, in chapter 12, he's continuing on the same thought. Now, he's listed all these things according to the flesh, and in chapter 12, he's going to talk about his revelation, that which he's seen, but it's not allowed to reveal. I must needs glory, though it is not expedient, but I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man in Christ 14 years ago. When is 2 Corinthians written? What's the date? 56. I don't know what Bill told you, but...
55.
Okay. 56, I think, is the correct date. I spent... Maybe not. That's, in my mind, I'm satisfied with that date. So 14 minus 56 is 42. That means he's in Tarsus of Cilicia. Now, do you remember? Let's just go back to Acts real quick. From Damascus, he went to Jerusalem. The Jews had a plot against him there. The brethren told him, look, you've got to leave. That's Acts 9. And Paul says, the Lord told me to go in Acts 22. Okay? So he leaves Jerusalem, he goes to Caesarea, and then where does he go? Up to Tarsus of Cilicia. And he's going to stay there until Barnabas comes and picks him up in Acts chapter 11. Do you remember that? Is it coming back to your mind now? Okay. That's a number of years later. That's, I think, 44. Right around there. So 42, he's still in Tarsus. So this vision occurs in Tarsus. He continues. Whether in the body I know not, or whether out of the body I know not. God knoweth. Such a one caught up even to the third heaven. The Jews believed in three heavens. Heaven, the atmosphere. Heaven, the celestial heavens, the stars, the canopy that surrounds us at night. And then heaven, the abode of God, is the third heaven. Okay? So that's the reference here. He's caught up into paradise. The term paradise is from a Persian word originally. It meant a garden. When the Septuagint translators of the Greek Old Testament, translating Hebrew into Greek, 280 BC, Alexandria, Egypt, translated Genesis, they put paradise, this word, the Greek word for paradise, to represent the Garden of Eden. Okay, so that gives you, maybe that'll help you in your mind to fix the concept. So he's caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words which it is not lawful for a man to utter. On behalf of such a one will I glory, but on mine own behalf I will not glory save in my weaknesses. I have to tell you a little story. You all have heard of Mary Baker Eddy, haven't you? Founder of the Christian Scientists. All right, well, she claimed to have a similar experience. She was caught up into the third heaven. And that when she got up there, she saw the two tablets of stone. And she saw a glow around the fourth commandment. Seventh-day Adventist, not Christian Scientists. Around the fourth commandment of the Ten Commandments. Do you remember what that fourth commandment was? Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy.
And so she said, I have come back to earth and I'm telling everyone about this message. And I'll never forget reading Brother Foy Wallace's argument on this passage. He used to say this. He said, I guess old Mary Baker Eddy went up into heaven and she saw that commandment encircled in glory, and the Lord just let her tell it to men anyway. He didn't let Paul, but he let her. He said, I guess the Lord knew she's a woman, she's going to tell anyway. Well, men have as big a mouth as women, but we have to kid them a little. But again, who is he glorying on here? He's even in chapter 11, he's not raising Paul up and exalting Paul. He talks about his weaknesses. Now here, who's he talking about? This isn't something Paul's done. The Lord's done this. Paul was caught up. He's seen these things. But let's continue. For if I should desire to glory, I shall not be foolish, for I shall speak the truth, but I forbear lest any man should account me above that which he seeth me to be or heareth from me. I'm not great. All right, now the revelation in me is, but not me. And so I've had to forbear so that people would not esteem me above that which I am. Just a human, just a man. And by reason of the exceeding greatness of the revelations, that I should not be exalted over much, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, that I should not be exalted over much. What is the thorn in the flesh? Okay, let me catch up in my notes. Here are some of the possibilities suggested. Epilepsy. Sir William Ramsey suggested that. It's not just a blind guess. He had some reasons for it. Hysteria. Periodic depressions. Well, Paul was periodically depressed, but that's not the thorn in the flesh. Headaches. Severe eye trouble. And I said epilepsy was suggested by Ramsey. Let me back up on that. Ramsey suggested malaria. Okay, malaria. Do you know anything about malaria? It comes and it goes. You have it for a while, and then it leaves. Okay, and Ramsey thought that Paul might have got that in Acts 13, and that he went up into the higher country of Galatia. He got it down in the swampy areas, right down over here. Perga and Pamphylia. And he said maybe this is why John Mark turned back, because Paul changed the itinerary. They went up into the higher, drier climate, up into the mountains here, in order to get away from that swamp, maybe to recuperate from malaria. Well, Ramsey knew the geography, but whether that's right or not, no one knows. His guess is a guess. That's all it is. Others have said leprosy. Others have said an impediment in his speech. Now, a lot of people think eyesight. From some of the statements in Galatians. You would have plucked your eyes out and given them to me. See with how large letters I write unto you. Those are the two most famous statements. Some people even see this eyesight trouble in Acts 23:1. Paul looked steadfastly on the council. He couldn't see him, so he had to really squint, to focus in on. Well, that's reading entirely too much into the context. But whatever it was, we can say this much about it. It was a physical ailment. Now, some people have held the position that it was persecution. No, that's not right. It's a thorn in the flesh. Physical ailment. Now what? We'll never be sure. It's not important that we know. It's interesting to try and figure it out. But there are a lot of other things you can spend your time worrying about other than that are more important. Okay? Now he says, concerning this I besought the Lord thrice that it might depart from me. And he has said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Paul, I've given this to you for a reason. It's to keep you humble. Verse 10, wherefore I take pleasure in weaknesses, in injuries, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake, for when I am weak, then am I strong. Now, he begins at this point to discuss the signs of an apostle. This is chapter 12, verses 11 through 18. Now, let me just summarize this. It's not hard to understand these verses. The only thing he's saying is, when I came, I wrought the signs of an apostle, the miracles of an apostle. And you'll note verse 12, signs, wonders, and mighty works are all mentioned. Same as in Acts 2. Do you remember the verse? Acts 2. You can see it in your Bible, can't you? See that on that page. 2:22. Three terms. Signs denote purpose. They point to something. Wonders denotes result or effect. Mighty works denote source. It's too mighty for man to do alone. Deity is involved. So there's the emphasis of the three separate groups. Now he says in verse 14, behold, this is the third time I am ready to come to you. The third time, you go back to Acts and he's only been there once. Well, some people said he intended to come another time, but he was held up. You remember, he discussed that in the first chapter and in chapter 2. All right, but note chapter 13, verse 1, this is the third time I am coming to you. When did he go the second time? Apparently, when he was right over here at Ephesus, where he wrote 1 Corinthians from, he had made a quick trip across and had come back. Bill, I think, has discussed that with you, hadn't he? Okay, that must have happened. Now, he changes again in chapter 19, or verse 19 of chapter 12, through the end of chapter 13. And in this passage, he is going to put the burden on the Corinthians. Basically, this is what he says. When I came, I performed the signs of an apostle. You saw them, didn't you? Well, they have to agree. How can they deny it? Empirical proof. They saw it with their own eyes. So now, look at what he does. Verse 20 of chapter 12. Let's begin here. I fear lest by any means when I come, I should find you not such as I would, and should myself be found of you such as ye would not. Lest by any means there should be strife, jealousy, wrath. And he lists these things that he's afraid that they will have. All right? Now he says that when he comes, that they had better be straightened up. That's the point. Now drop down to chapter 13, verse 1. At the mouth of two witnesses or three shall every word be established. I have said beforehand, and I do say beforehand, as when I was present the second time, so now being absent to them that have sinned heretofore and to all the rest, that if I come, I will not spare. And then he says, you seek a proof that Christ is speaking in me, don't you? You want to put me on trial. And then in verse 5, he's going to turn the scales and look what he does. He says, try your own selves, whether ye are in the faith. Prove your own selves. Or know ye not as to your own selves that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed ye be reprobate? Now, this is his argument. How did you become a Christian, in effect? Now, this is his argument, 1 Corinthians 9. Well, one of the implications of his argument here is that if Christ wasn't in me, how can you expect Christ to be in you? How did you hear about Christ? Well, I told you. Now, if Christ wasn't in me, how can he be in you? Well, he can't. That's the obvious implication. So what he's saying is, prove your own selves. And verse 6, he says, but I hope that ye, or verse the end of verse 5, or know ye not as to your own selves that Jesus Christ is in you, and indeed ye be reprobate. And the term reprobate means to fail the test. You put yourselves to the test, and if you fail, you're reprobate. And then he concludes the epistle. He's concluding with that. And he says in verse 10, I'm writing these final things, I'm writing sharply, so that when I'm present with you, I won't have to deal sharply. And then the full conclusion. Verse 14, the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the communion of the Holy Spirit be with you all. All three members of the Godhead are mentioned. Christ, God, and the Holy Spirit in the final verse. Any questions? All right. That was kind of a quick trip. I'll tell you what, try to remember the three main points. What are they? One more time and then let's close. What are the three points of 2 Corinthians? The three things that he really deals with. The nature of his ministry. All right? What's the second thing? Chapters 8 and 9. The collection. And the third thing, chapters 10 through 13, his apostleship. Ministry, collection, apostleship. Well, I'll tell you what. In Chronicles, we had to cover, in history courses, we covered Joshua through Esther. All in one course. So I had to cover 1 Chronicles in 1 week and 2 Chronicles in 1 week. I mean, I intended to do that. That was my plan. But
the fact that you did.
Well, 36 chapters, you know, it's just kind of like, well, you say, well, in those